Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Lynn Oliver, author, co-founder of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, a self-described chapter book gateway drug. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 276 of the podcast with Lynn Oliver, author most recently of the Fantastic Frames series. If you write for children, I suspect you may already know Lynn Oliver from her involvement in founding the SCBWI. If you're an adult, perhaps you associate her with Henry Winkler, her co-author in the Hank Zipser series. And if you're me, you've quickly embraced Lynn for the kind and caring person she is beyond all of her impressive accomplishments in children's publishing. Lynn and I bumped into one another at the Texas Library Association's annual conference last spring, and the mutual admiration society was immediately evident. I hope you enjoy taking the next 30 or so minutes to get to know Lynn as I did in this conversation. A quick warning, this episode acknowledges the existence of children, which is just my fancy way of saying that our 16-month-old was persistently trying to cameo on this conversation, which you'll hear in the beginning of the episode. Our 6-year-old also pops in to say hi. All bedtime norms go out the window when you're on summer break. Regardless, here's episode number 276 of the podcast with Lynn Oliver. Welcome to the podcast, Lynn Oliver. I've waited to talk to you. I'm excited.
Well, thank you. I'm excited to talk to you, too.
I want
to
say first and foremost, well, there's a lot of things I want to say. I owe you a thank you, as do so many of us for SCBWI and your work for that. I owe you a thank you as a librarian because your books take up such a significant amount on my bookshelf, but during the school year, they take up just a little bit of space because all the kids have the books checked out.
Oh, but that's the best news ever.
But for me personally, I wanted to thank you because we just had like a random happened chance meeting at TLA, and it was such an honor to get to meet you and just to see you in the flesh. It was really fun for me.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. And, you know, the service that you perform for the children's book community is just amazing. You know, we need people who do what I do, who sort of create literature, and then we need people who curate and promote and let the community know what's available. So we, as a community, are completely appreciative of you and what you do.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's been neat to be, as a school librarian of somewhere around 12 years now, to go from the work that I do in collaboration with other teachers and things like that to a space where... Oh, my daughter is saying hi.
Oh, hello.
Julia and John are saying hi. Well, that answers the question about bedtime, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
Bye, blow kisses.
I'll send them kisses, too.
Oh, There you go. Night. Auntie Lynn sends kisses.
Night. They'll be back.
Yeah. Well, it's summer. It's a good time to be with your children. We're both teachers. So
yeah.
Where I was leading with that is just to say that it's been neat to serve as a teacher, as an educator, and then from starting this podcast to be able to have my foot in that other world and to be able to serve children through literature on both ways by talking to people like you that are creating books and out there with kids at festivals and at school visits. But then on my end that I get to be on that side too of championing your books and putting them into the hands of kids. It's a really blessed life, I think, that I'm living.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all lucky. You know, so most of my best friends are children's book creators of some ilk or another. And we talk a lot about that, how lucky we are that our life's work has inherent meaning. Because yes. we're contributing in the most direct and fundamental way to the next generation. And we're very lucky. We don't have to search for meaning. It's right there.
You're right. It's all right there. It's a really beautiful thing that we have going this way. And I just think of like all the more and more the people that I get to meet in publishing when I go to these conferences and when I'm out there, the way that everyone, and you've seen this with SCBWI, but the way that everyone is championing one another, and more importantly, the way that so many adults are rallying around children and around putting good stories into their hand and connecting with children. I feel like where in the world does anyone work so hard to connect with someone that I mean, we all were children at one point, but still to work so hard and to value those young minds the way that everyone that I've met respects them that way. It's just, I mean, it's amazing.
Well, I think that the people who write for children and draw for children have a special connection to their own childhood. And something that I always say at SCBWI is most of us were probably never cheerleaders in high school. Right. You know, that I think that writers in general and creators in general get sampled as sort of from the outlying community, you know. And so we remember childhood in a different way. It's not an idealized time. It's a real time where you're trying to sort out your identity and who you are and struggle through childhood to become, you know, an authentic adult. So that becomes automatically the topic for everyone in one way or another. Most books for children and young people are about that, are about the search to establish your most authentic self. And that if that's your life quest, it sort of automatically makes you a good person.
Oh, I love that. I love the idea that in having a heart that pure, that you just sort of become a good person. I like that.
Well, you're in touch with the struggle, I think.
Yeah.
It is. It's not that our hearts are necessarily pure.
No.
They're complicated. They might even be wicked or evil, but we're in touch with what the struggle is to sort of realize yourself as a person.
Yeah.
And so that's the subtext of all children's books. It's a subtext really of all literature, which is why we want to rely on our artists and writers as people who establish policies, you know, and it's why writers and artists have always been so fundamental to intellectual freedom and to society, because we're kind of leading the charge for compassion, for authenticity, for understanding.
Oh my word, just listening to you, you are so the right person to be behind SCBWI. I love it. All right, so let's talk. I want to hear about you coming to writing, and I want to hear about you and Stephen and SCBWI. But first, I want to talk about your new books that you're working on, the new books that are coming out. You have
a
fantastic frame. I've got two of them. I had the honor of reading two.
Yeah, they're only two out. There's a third one coming out in a couple months.
Are you doing like two a year? Is that about the publication schedule?
Yeah, I think that's going to be about it. So the Fantastic Frame is a chapter book series, you know, intended for kids who are early readers, not necessarily beginning readers, I would say first grade to fourth grade. And it came out of a personal story. Should I tell you the personal story?
I would love to. Yeah, I'd love to hear that.
It's a little disrespectful of my family, but I I know they'll hang in there with me and understand. So I'm the mother of three sons, three very robust, active sons. And we had a family policy where every summer we would try and rent a place somewhere exotic in the world and settle down for like 2 or 3 weeks vacation. So one year we decided to go to Italy, and we rented a little house outside of Florence. And I talked up the history of Italian Renaissance art and Florence and how they were going to love this, and the very essence of painting was there. And they kind of rolled their eyes, but, you know, they said, can we go to a soccer game too? Sure. So the day came when we were going into Florence to go to the Uffizi Gallery, the most famous art museum in the world. And we went there. The boys were between sort of 9 and 13. And the first disaster was that it wasn't air conditioned, and it was about 195 inside. And we weren't in there for 10 seconds when they started asking how soon we could go and where the gelato was. So I then said, you know, this is art history at its best. And the truth was they were not at all interested. And so finally, I said to them, I gathered them around, and I said, listen, guys, this is art. This is the greatest art in the world. And my middle son said in a really loud voice, I just hate art. And everyone, there was a silence that fell over the entire city of Florence, I think. And everyone stared at me. There we were, the ugly Americans with these three teenage boys who were declaring to the Italian population that they hated art. So we left with our tail between our legs, and I thought, what a failure I am as a mother. And then later that summer, I was talking to a friend who, I don't know if you have friends like this, but she is the perfect mother. And so she was telling me that they had just come back from Europe, and her sons had loved Florence. And I said, oh, what did they love about it? She said, they just loved the Uffizi Gallery. No. They couldn't get enough of it. She said, didn't your boys love it? And I said, oh, yes. We could barely get them out. So then I said to her, finally I ate crow, and I said, what is it that they liked? What did you do? And she said, well, we had a scavenger hunt. She said, I made a list before we went in of 15 things I wanted them to find in the paintings. Go look for the woman in the blue hat. Go look for the... And the boys had such a great time, and they ran around to all the galleries, and they looked at all the Botticellis, and they just couldn't get enough of it. And that made me realize that when kids relate to art, they need a they need something to focus on. They don't have what we have. They don't have an appreciation, a built-in appreciation of what you're supposed to love about art. So they're looking at a painting. And particularly modern-day kids are used to looking at photographs. So what if you see a landscape of the French countryside? They don't know what they're supposed to appreciate. And that idea kind of lay dormant in my mind for 10 years. And I kept thinking of how is it that we can get kids to love art, to love what we love about art. And gradually I came to the realization that what we love is being inside the painting, not standing, looking at it, and kind of dissertating to ourselves about the importance of 15th century art or whatever, but being inside the painting and really being a part of it. And since I love art so much and I love art history so much, and since it's not being taught in our schools any longer because of cutbacks, music and art have really gone by the wayside.
Amen to that.
That was when I decided to create a series kind of like the Magic Treehouse, which I think serves a huge purpose in kids' life. It makes history real. It puts them in the middle of history. That puts kids in the middle of art, in the middle of a painting, so that it accomplishes what I wasn't able to do with my own children that day in Florence, which is to put them inside a painting and love it from the inside out, and also at the same time provide a great adventure, a great fantasy, and kind of a great deal about art and what makes art great and what makes art history relevant without having to ever lecture them by doing it through story.
That notion is I think the heart of a teacher there. How do I get a kid not to just me tell them this is important, it's important for you to learn this, but rather how do I get you to articulate that back to me without me even saying it?
And to feel it in your heart, particularly
to feel it, yes.
Art. Because art is all about, aha, that's so beautiful. It's not about, oh, this was painted in that style and derived from that style. You know, that's something we learn later in life, but it's all an intellectual concept. what we love about art is, oh my gosh, that's so beautiful.
Yes. Or it's so threatening. It's so, I mean, the feeling in your first book, and then it's Danger, Tiger Crossing. Mm-hmm. In your first book, you're looking at Surprise, Tiger in Tropical Storm mm-hmm. by Henri Rousseau. And in that, to be able to put yourself literally into that painting means to put yourself into danger, to put yourself there when this tiger is crouched and ready to strike. So to be able to feel that, to be able to feel the wind that's pulling the leaves, to be able to feel all of those things, how better to do that for a child of age 8, 9, 10 than to have a story where you literally go inside there and feel it, because that's what we adults do. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's what they are. Well, we adults do it somewhat, you know, when you go to a museum, you kind of whiz by and you say, oh yes, that's important. That's a very important painting. You know, but to really stop, you know, when you go to a museum, it's actually more fun to choose 5 or 10 paintings and just sit down in front of them than to try and cover the whole show.
That's the value of having, by getting a docent to tour with you. Just because they don't take you to every single thing. It's let's look at these, and sometimes even just to gaze and to ask, well, what's connecting with you? I don't want to tell you what makes this piece important, but rather, how are you interacting with it?
And a lot of paintings have a narrative, you know, and a lot of paintings don't. So it's very interesting to choose one. The first one I chose, so the premise of Fantastic Frame is two 10-year-old kids, Tiger and Luna, who live in Los Angeles. They live in a duplex, and next door to them is sort of the crazy old woman of, you know, on the block. You know, she was kind of based on Mrs. Havisham and Great Expectations, you know, a woman who hasn't left the house in 50 years. And it turns out that she is in possession of a magical picture frame, a frame that when you stand next to it can suck you into the painting that's enclosed inside the frame. And this happened to her son, David, 50 years earlier. And so he's been lost inside paintings. And every week, she paints a copy of another great masterpiece, puts it in the frame in the hopes that he will appear and she can somehow get him back. So that's kind of the premise. So she is too old and too frail and too feeble to be able to go into the frame herself, but Luna and Tiger aren't. So she enlists their help to enter the frame every week and search for her son, David. So the first painting that is up there is, as you say, Henri Rousseau's Tiger in a Tiger in a Tropical Storm. And so they're pulled into the painting and at the exact spot where the painting takes place. So they come face to face with a growling tiger who is prepared to lurch towards them. He's crouched, ready to jump. And so they're thrown into an adventure. They only have an hour. The rule of the magic is that the frame's hour of power is only viable for an hour. So they have an hour to get into the painting, to search for David, to try and find him, and to get back at exactly the strike of 5 to exactly the place that they were when they entered the painting. And then they can come back out. So, of course, in the arc of the series, they're looking for David. They find him. They don't find him. They find him, and he doesn't want to come back. There are all sorts of sort of subtexts that happen. But the essence is, in each book, they are thrust inside a painting where they have an adventure looking for the son of the woman next door, Viola Dots.
And I should point out, too, that you start off the surrealism of this story immediately from the very first page of the very first book that we, do you mind if I read an excerpt?
No, I love it. I'm going to sit back and enjoy it.
Well, I just love how it starts. It's so funny. Having young children at my house, I just think, so here we go. Chapter 1. I saw a giant orange pig on our swing set this morning, said my little sister Maggie. He was wearing a fancy black hat. We were eating tuna melts at the kitchen table in our new house. Of course he was, I said, and I bet he was playing Jingle Bells on the tuba. Everyone knows pigs don't play tuba, Maggie snapped, sticking her tongue out at me. And then when you turn the page, you see also that there's illustration in this chapter book, which I wanted to comment on as well. But to have a story start out with something that seems like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, and then to go, No, but what if it's not the most ridiculous thing?
Yeah.
What if,
yeah.
What if, as you're reading this story, for me too, I think we've taken our children to a number of art museums, and Jonah is now getting to an age where he can start remembering some of the things he's seen and talk about it. And to have it be, what was that painting with the orange pig, or what was that painting with the tiger, or the one where the ship was in that storm?
Yeah.
Those, to be able to boil it down to those couple words is exactly the reference point that I think about when my readers will read this, that there's going to be little clues that you drop there that they're going to go, wait, I know what you're talking about. We talked about it in art class.
Yes.
The one with the hay, yeah.
When I go to schools, I bring with me a slideshow that I made, a PowerPoint, that's 50 of the greatest paintings from art history. And I cut it to Happy by Pharrell Williams. And what's interesting is the kids recognize a lot of the paintings, and they're laughing and screaming and yelling. They see the Mona Lisa. They see the Matisse of the dancing naked women, and they scream, you know, with delight. They see the Magritte, you know, the man with the apple for a head, and they think that's the funniest thing. So they don't have prejudices about how you're supposed to appreciate fine art. They just think it's cool. So if we can catch them at that point when they're looking at a painting of the ship, and I know which exact one you're referring to, Ship in a Storm, or they're looking at Washington crossing the Delaware, we're getting them when it's very interesting.
Right. That pure before, sense of reacting, before, that before we get to the criticism of
that's
art.
That's right. Before you get to literary criticism, before you get to art history, where we as adults have the infinite knack of taking something wondrous and turning it into drudgery.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Taking something wondrous and turning it into drudgery. Like only an adult can.
and the kids they don't know that this is supposed to be something boring, because it isn't. It's inherently exciting. So you just have to tell it from a way that's exciting.
And you've got this great quote here that I think sort of captures how the whole thing works, too. Halfway through the first story, Viola, the woman who's missing her son, says, "The world of art is timeless. The people we see in paintings live on forever, unchanged."
Yeah, that's of course, the beauty of it. That's a classic theme in all sort of literature, that the only way any of us is going to achieve immortality is in art. You know, that's, you know, the John Keats poem, the Grecian Urn, you know, that's been a long time theme. And I think it's something that kids can essentially understand, you know, even with a photograph. You know, it's not all Snapchat. It doesn't disappear after 20 seconds, you know. It's you can create something, a book or a painting or a photograph, or anything from your own life that lasts longer than just the moment. And that's to me, that's a goal. It's a goal that we all have, whether you're doing it through art or just through your life, or you're passing down a recipe from generation to generation. We're all kind of looking to leave a little fingerprint, right?
Correct.
And so the art is just another way that some people do it.
I love in the spot illustrations done in this story that are done by Samantha Callis.
Callis, yes.
That to have that decision of all of the time in the story that takes place in the now, in the here, is in black and white. But when we go into that painting, suddenly the illustrations turn to color.
So glad you noticed that.
Seeing things in color, seeing things for the first time. It reminded me of that movie Pleasantville, where you're finally seeing things the way that they are. Yeah, I love that.
Turns into color. And, you know, that was a great decision. That was from the art directors at Penguin. And that was a great decision. And also, when you go into the painting and now you're in full color art, a lot of those illustrations are full page. So that's kind of reminiscent of the way you would have an Andrew Wyeth front piece, or, you know, it's a full page of an action-adventure scene.
Yes.
So they're not only just spot illustrations, and kids love that, and they get the and in some of the books, in a later one to come, as you go into the art, as you go into the painting, the style actually changes to be somewhat in the style of the painting.
Ooh.
Like the second book is the George Seurat, you know, Sundays in the Park. And that's a pointillist. So it's all done. There's no brush strokes. Every color is applied by a dot of paint, by a point of paint. And as the kids are racing to get back before the hour of power is over, they look at their arms and they're starting to turn into dots. They're starting to become part of the painting and lose their skin and become actual just points of light. So it gives kids who are reading the story insight not only to what the narrative of the painting is, but the style of the painting.
Yes, and one of the other things I didn't want to pass by, in case there are people out there that haven't had the opportunity to take their kids to an art museum, or I mean, some of the people we're listening to are illustrators, and so maybe they've had this experience or done it themselves. But I like being so close to DC myself. When we go to the National Art Gallery or other places like that, to see people there with their paints set up, painting replicas of these famous works of art, and to see how beautiful a replica can be, and to know that this story is about a woman that does that. Because I think, again, to think about how apart sometimes it feels like we are from works of art. But
Matthew, have you ever taken an art class or a painting class or done any, studied it at all?
Oh, I have. I have.
Because I have too. I've taken some painting. I'm distinctly untalented. But what I love about it is when you're in the middle of the class, when you're taking painting, it actually provokes you to see the world differently.
Yes.
So that you're looking at it as if you were painting it. So suddenly you say, oh, that's not really green. That's more gray, you know. Or there really isn't a black line around people's face. The colors kind of fade from one to the other. So you start to see the world through the eyes as if you're trying to replicate it. And that's a very cool thing. And that's something that I hope that the series accomplishes also, to let kids feel free to express their own creativity and to mimic a painting, to mimic being in a painting.
Yeah.
To just take the colors, you know, in the Rousseau painting, it's all deep turquoise blues and dark reds and dark olive greens and dark stormy colors. And so I've done workshops with kids in classes where they just take those colors, the palette, and do a painting that's nothing like that painting except it's in the same palette.
Yeah.
So it gives them an opportunity to express themselves. But not just to do anything, to do something that comes from the stimulus of the painting, looking at the painting.
I think there, right there, is the mark of a great teacher. The art teacher we have at our school, I'll just say her name in case she listens, Lori Melendick. She's phenomenal at being an individual that can bring out that viewpoint in anyone's art, that all of our children, all 800 of our students at our school that go to art class can express themselves through art, because they are given the tools and the scenario and the right stimulus to be able to do that. Yeah, and I think about, so when I was in different art classes in college, that I made things that I can't imagine I would have been able to do just sitting down right now and doing it. I have a piece that I actually keep on my wall of art from some of my favorite children's literature that I was inspired by in my art class. And I just felt like, I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad that I was in that moment to do it. Yeah.
Well, think what a respite it is in a child's day at school to be able to do something where there's no right and wrong answer, where there's no test score, where there's no objective way to measure your success except by how you feel. Yes. And we don't do enough of that in school. And so art and music provide an opportunity, you know, for self-expression and to not have to question yourself and doubt yourself. You can just follow whatever impulse you have, whatever feeling you have. And to me, that's so necessary for everyone in every day of their life to have moments like that where there's no judgment.
Yeah. My goodness, I feel like I'm here in therapy with you, and you're just sort of like taking care of, you're right,
therapy.
You're right, Lynn, you're validating all of the things that I've been feeling now.
Well, we all feel that as people who involved in education, that, yes, you know, these poor little kids today, these kiddos are beleaguered by standardized tests and measurement of every aspect of their life. And, you know, we all know that once you're out of school, no one's measuring anything, but they don't know that. So to be able to provide some time in the day, reading does that too, where you can just relax and let your imagination guide you and not the rules. What a wonderful thing. And also in studying the lives of artists, like the first four fantastic frames, one is about Henri Rousseau, one is about George Seurat, the third one is Edward Hopper, and the fourth one is Georgia O'Keeffe. Mm. And so at the end of every book, there's a section, a small section, on the life of the artist and the creation of that particular painting. And so what they get to see is that these artists were all breaking rules and kind of going at it their own way. You know, Henri Rousseau was not a professional artist. He was a ticket taker. He worked in the customs office in Paris, basically letting people onto the highway. And then he had this entirely other sort of secret life as a painter. And when he was first exhibited, he was laughed at. People thought he was laughable. They called him the tax collector, you know. But look at him now. Now he's like one of the most kind of legendary artists, you know, of his century. And the same with Georgia O'Keeffe. You know, she was completely a rule breaker. There were no women fine artists, and there certainly weren't women who wandered alone out in the desert of New Mexico painting cow skulls. You know, but her fame was based on her kind of trying to realize a true identity and a true form of self-expression. And I think that's really good for kids to see. Once again, not making it a lesson, just, hey, do you like this painting? Did you like this adventure? Well, look who did it.
Yes.
And suddenly their role models are not just politicians and people who, you know, wage wars and create one kind of history, but people who create another kind of cultural history.
I love that.
I do too.
This care that you have for children, for connecting with them, for inspiring them this way, for writing for them, where did that come from? Have you always had that? I know that you used to write for... maybe you still do write for film and television,
yeah.
But to be writing specifically for children and for, most often I see you writing for this chapter book age.
Mm-hmm. I like those kids.
Yeah. I like them too. Why do you like them?
Give me those kids. I can make them readers. You know, yeah. I feel like mm-hmm. what I write and the work that I do with Henry Winkler too on the Hank books.
Yes.
And I feel like if you can give me kids the transition into reading, I am the gateway drug to Dostoevsky, you know. that if you teach them early on, you know, I don't know that I'm a great writer in the sense of look at our great, you know, Katherine Patterson or Susan Cooper or but what I do think is that I'm a popular writer, that I can create popular entertainments that have merit. And so if kids can read my books, which are mostly series and they're very fast-paced and usually they're funny and they're very accessible and get very fluent in reading and learn to regard it as a pleasure, then the sky's the limit for them. Then they can read anything. And I think so often at those ages, at those transitional ages of 7, 8, 9, 10, kids get turned off by things that they're supposed to be reading that are either too hard or too dark or too symbolic or yeah. too sober. And, you know, I read plenty of things that are funny or light. I'll say it right here on your podcast. I read People Magazine. I read other things too, but why shouldn't a child be able to read for pleasure, to read for a laugh, to read for an exciting thrill?
Yes.
And what that does, particularly at that age, is create fluency so that reading becomes second nature. And that's part of what my books do. That's part of why I choose that age to write for, because you're creating a habit and creating an ease with the printed word that I think is going to last them a lifetime if they like what they find.
Were you a reader at this age, at 7 to 9?
Yeah, I was a rebellious kid. You know, I was one of two sisters, and I had, my older sister was quite perfect in every way. And so I turned out to be less than perfect, and my parents were very strict, and there were a lot of rules, and I am like an anti-authoritarian in every part, in every cell of my body, you know. So the way I got out of what I was supposed to do and the rules I was supposed to follow was by A, reading, and B, making up stories. My parents called it lying, which it was, because I would make up phenomenal things that happened to me, or, you know, try and get out of a rule by saying, well, you know, I know I wasn't supposed to take the bus into the city, but, you know, I met a man with a kangaroo, and he, you know, and I was off on a story. So I think both the reading part and the storytelling part were a way for me to escape, kind of what I was talking about with kids in school, you know, to escape the rules and to be just to kick back and have fun. I think that's what I wanted. And it was
good.
Around me, there were people saying, no, 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 you have to work on your penmanship. No, you have to, you know, you're that, oh, that has to be you have to have a topic sentence and a paragraph or whatever the rules were. I wanted to bend them to suit me.
Yeah.
So I think writing came out of that, and certainly reading. You know, reading is a great thing because most writers are iconoclasts in some way, right? So you're reading about someone who's just a little under the radar. You know, I wrote a series a few years ago called "Who Shrunk Daniel Funk," and it's a little higher than chapter book. They're sort of middle grade novels about a kid who shrinks to the size of a toe and discovers he has a tiny twin brother. And I think the reason I wrote that is the idea of being invisible, of being under the radar, of being able to do anything that you want to do without your parents telling you that that was against the rules, was always so appealing to me. You know, the sort of anti-authoritarian. One of the things I love about the Fantastic Frame is these kids can disappear into a world where there's no adult authority, and they have to rely on their own cleverness and their own ingenuity and their own strengths to get them back. And that just seems, for any child, a great opportunity to be free of the adult constraints and test out who you are.
Yeah. Well, so what brought you to writing with Henry Winkler? I know that you, I assume you met him through working on film and in television.
Yeah.
But to bring, to take that relationship into then writing for children is I mean, the relationship you've had together, the partnership you've had has been amazing. I love those books. Our students love those books.
Yeah.
But why it even started in the first place is great.
Well, I met him, you know, I've spent a great deal of my career writing and producing television, but mostly for kids and mostly based on great children's books. I did Wayside School. I did Corduroy. You know, I've always loved, from the time I was, you know, 20 and started the SCBWI, I've always loved children's books and their creators. So I met Henry. It was during sort of a lull in his career, in his acting career, and we had a shared friend who is a, you know, a very important Hollywood agent, and Henry was telling him that he's dyslexic, and our friend said, well, you should write about that for kids, and Henry said, well, duh, I'm dyslexic, you know, I can't write about this, and he said, well, let me introduce you to a friend, you know, who works in children's books. So Henry and I had lunch, and he told me his story, which was very, very moving to me, about how here is this sort of iconic Hollywood figure, you know, who's been a successful actor and director and producer. And he didn't know that he was dyslexic until he was in his mid-30s. And he just thought that he was stupid. He was told by his parents that he was stupid. He was underachieving all throughout high school. He only got into... There was only one college that accepted him, which has turned out to be Emerson and was a good school, but at the time it was just opening, so they were looking for like their first class. And in the end, he went to Yale graduate school, but he auditioned. So that's sort of the thing that I've always felt, which is everyone has to find their talent, and we don't all have to be good at everything.
Yes.
So when he told me the story, I was really moved by it. And at the time, my children were, as I said, I have three boys, and they were teenagers or the youngest was maybe 8 or 9. And boys in school, I don't know how your Jonah is, but it can be a tough road, you know?
He's only finished kindergarten, and there's been bumps already.
Yeah, well, they get bumpier. And so my kids were, you know, they were all good students, but they were, there was always, every time the phone rang, it was like, oh no, what now? You know, well, this one, you know, brought beach towels to class. I don't know, just whatever they were doing always seemed to be just a little not quite what the teacher wanted, you know, and what the teachers wanted was the rule of law and order and prompt assignments and neat assignments. And I gave birth to three kids who not one of them ever to remember to bring their Spanish book home on the night of the Spanish test, you know. So I really related to Henry's story. My kids weren't dyslexic, but I just feel that especially for young boys, the school system isn't always geared to understand their physical needs, their physical rambunctiousness and vigorousness. So we had a very deep and meaningful conversation about this, and we decided together to write something. I had been approached, because I've worked in film and television a lot, and I'd been approached by a lot of celebrities to work with them, you know, on doing a children's book.
Oh, the dreaded celebrity children's book.
God, and I always said no to, because who wants to do that? A, I'm not a ghostwriter, and B, most of their stories were pretty routine. But this, I thought, was an amazing story. So we created this character, Hank Zipser, who is a lot like Henry. He's handsome and smart and resourceful and funny and popular, and he just happens to stink at school because he has an undiagnosed learning challenge. So we wrote the first book and sold them, and we were overwhelmed by the reaction. We're just overwhelmed. Those books have sold over 4 million copies. And what touched us so much was the relief that parents felt and the kids felt about seeing in print a kid who was like them. You know, we get letters, we get hundreds of fan mail letters every month that say, how do you know me so well? How did you know that that's how I feel? How did you know that I forget my spelling words even when I know them? How, you know, and so the kids identify, and the parents feel such relief at meeting a kid who kind of matches theirs, who is successful in so many ways and just bumps up against the system. Right. So we were very touched by all of that, and we continue. So we've done 18 Hank Zipser books. We've done we've done 10 of a spin-off series called Here's Hank, about Hank when he's in the early readers, Hank when he's in the second grade. Mm-hmm. It's become a hit television show on the BBC, the Hank Zipser show.
I didn't realize really, that. Oh, wow.
It's a giant hit. And I'll tell you something interesting that we don't usually talk about. We tried to sell it here first as a television show. And every single network that we took it to loved the books. They said, oh, they're so funny. They're so smart. We love this. We just want one change. And this happened literally 5 times. And we said, what's that? And they said, could we make Hank less dyslexic? Or not dyslexic.
Could we change the character?
That's right, because we don't feel like American kids are ready for a flawed hero like that.
Oh, not and, ready. Ew, the way that anyone talks down about children is horrible.
Ew. Yeah, so we went ew, and we said no, 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 no. And then when it came to the attention of the BBC, they were thrilled that, you know, 1 in 5 kids has a learning challenge. So we're not, you know, if it's not you or your kid, it's the kid next door. And so the idea that everyone should sort of understand that we all learn differently and that this isn't a disability but just a difference, and that we all, you know, have our own kind of paths to success and each path is going to be individual, that didn't seem to be a message that American networks were ready to send. So we did it for the BBC, and it's a giant hit. In fact, Henry last year was awarded the OBE, the Order of the British Empire, by the Queen for his work in dyslexia.
That's amazing. What a champion story. That's great.
Yeah, it really is.
Lynn, we're reaching the end of our time. I want to honor our time. Mm-hmm. But first I wanted to ask just briefly about the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, of which I am a proud card-carrying member.
I am
and
so
have been
glad.
For years.
Good.
But I know that you co-founded it. I know that it's been years ago, and since I know that this organization has affected thousands and thousands of people's lives, mm-hmm. And in that way, millions of readers. Why help everyone? Why? I mean, I know why, but mm-hmm. why for you? What was the drive to start this? Because this was a massive undertaking.
Yeah. Well, the drive to start, I mean, I started when I was 21, so I don't think I knew what I was doing at all. You know, I think what happened was Steve Mooser and I were both offered a job that was a writing job that was creating a book series, an educational book series for kids in K-5. And we got the job by auditioning. So we were hired because of kind of raw writing talent. And then when we were told that we were going to be writing basically a reading curriculum from kindergarten through fifth grade, composed of short stories and chapter books and novels, and we were the sole writers, after our bosses left, we kind of turned to each other and said, I don't have a clue. And we were, even though we were kind of young idiots, we were smart enough to know that there was something to learn about writing for children. So we thought, well, we'll go to a conference or join an organization where we can learn this and study it. And there was none. This was in the 70s. There wasn't anything. So being brash, I said, well, let me do some research on this. So I went to where one always goes, to the local librarian when one needs help, right?
Yay.
I went to the Santa Monica Public Library, and the librarians here gave me stacks and stacks of children's books to read, and I read all the best authors at the time. And then I wrote them letters. I wrote 10 letters saying, we're having a conference, you know, about writing for children. Would you like to come? Literally, I was 21 and I wrote these letters. I wrote to Judy Blume and Tom Paola and E.B. White and Dr. Seuss and Don Freeman. I just, you know, and of the 10 letters, I got 10 back, which right away blew, right? So
yes.
You say, there's something about this community that I want to be part of.
Can I ask you, Lynn, did you keep the letters?
Oh, yes.
Oh!
Of the 10 said, yes, I'd love to.
8 of the 10? Oh, my goodness.
8 of 10. And the only two who said no, one was E.B. White, and he said that he wasn't feeling well, and he thought Charlotte and he needed to stay in the barn. And it turned out that he passed away later that summer. So, and the other rejection was from Dr. Seuss, who wrote his declined answer in verse, in rhyme, which I still have.
Wow.
And everyone else said yes. So suddenly we were hosting a conference, and we thought, well, we best figure out an organization. So we created, along with a woman named Sue Alexander, who devoted so much of her life to this, we called it the Society of Children's Book Writers, the most awkward name we could think of. And suddenly we had a post office box and an organization and a conference to run. That's really the way it started. That was 44 years ago. And now there are 25,000 members. It's a nonprofit, of course, you know, helping organization. Steve and I did it for years and years and years and years just as volunteers, because we loved it. And for me, as I segued from children's books into film and television, I kept doing it because it was my sanity. You know, it was the film and television world isn't necessarily the kindest world, and there's a lot of competition and backstabbing, and in this field of children's book creators, everybody was reaching out a helping hand to the next person, to bring along the next generation. To, you know, there was Jane Yolen or Paula Dansker sitting at a conference helping somebody who had never published before to refine their manuscript, and so it was kind of it was literally sanity to say, in this world, there's a community of people who are selfless, who care about ideas larger than themselves and their own successes, and therefore, by the way, make themselves successful. Judy Blume has been on our board since the inception, and she says all the time, I wish when I was starting out there was a group like this. I had no one. She was sitting in New Jersey writing books that people were criticizing because they were too scandalous, you know? So I've seen over the years all the great writers and illustrators of our time not only develop their own career and their craft, but help discover there are literally thousands of books that have been published because of the SCBWI, yes. Not because of Steve or me, but because of the people who gather in this community being willing to help. And so the when we started, I think was kind of the first golden age of children's books. There was Tommy DiPaola and Don Freeman and Judy Blume and Clyde Robert Bulla. But those people gave way to a new generation of the names that are now the big names. You know, we knew Peter Brown or Matthew LaPena before they were published.
Yes.
Or Jay Asher. Jay Asher, I hope he doesn't get angry at this story. We used to have a joke contest every month where people would send in jokes and we'd publish the winner. Jay Asher won every single month for like 2 years. And people were saying,
word.
Who is this guy? This must be fixed. But we got to know him through that. And we said, this guy's a great writer. And stood by and supported him and supported him and supported him until he found his true voice, which was 13 Reasons Why. So there are so many of those kind of success stories that have come out of this organization that we all feel lucky, lucky to be involved in it and lucky to be part of this incredible community. And what we all feel is that you might find people that you like or more than others, but you're never going to find anyone who's like a creeper, in this field, these are people who care. And, that's a pretty cool thing to be spending your life around. So we feel lucky and fortunate, and it's really, really fun to stand by and bear witness to all these new great careers sprouting up,
Yes. Well, I think we all are lucky and fortunate to have your work in our life and Stephen's work in that way too, to help us be connected. I've made so many friends through SCBWI, and I have to say that I get teased. I'm just going to call out somebody on the podcast. I get teased all the time for calling out my friend Carter Higgins because she's such a close friend
she's
of
great.
Mine. But the
she's
only
great.
Only thing mentioned more than Carter Higgins, and she could attest to this, is SCBWI is mentioned more than anything else on this podcast. And
is that right?
I think, again, it's a testament to just the connective mm-hmm. power, the support, the love that everyone feels. And now it's a place that everyone sort of points to as where to start. Oh, you're interested in writing for children? Well, first, get into this network and get to know people and find that mm-hmm. support. And that's a beautiful thing. Especially, I always look at it as a librarian that likewise as a librarian, we in our field often are completely alone in our buildings. We are the only librarian, the only person doing what we're doing that same way. We do teach, we do things similar to the other teachers in the building, but really it's the power of reaching out at conferences and online through Twitter and Facebook and things like that to find like-minded teacher librarians and to be connected and to be inspired. SCBWI serves the writing community in that beautiful way too. And I sure am grateful that it exists. And really, Lynn, I'm grateful for everything that you're doing. You are a presence in my life and also in our library, in the lives of our readers. So thank you for all of that.
Thank you, Matthew. That's very, very sweet and tender and meaningful.
Lynn, I'm gonna end our conversation here, and I will look forward to many in the future, I hope. But mm-hmm. I do want to end on giving you the last word, but for the sake of our readers, I want to end with this. I'm going to see a library full of children, well, not tomorrow, but I'll see them soon. So, mm-hmm. Lynn, I want to know, what message would you like me to bring them from you?
Well, I would like all children to know.
Telephone.
Excuse me. That's the message coming through. I would like all children to know that reading brings you into other worlds, and that for all of us to experience other worlds is a crucial part of our humanity. That the only way you can ever know yourself is by knowing others, and that when you know, truly know and understand others, you are going to feel empathy and compassion, and you're not going, and you're going to reach for those as tools for interacting rather than other tools that mankind has traditionally reached for, like strife and conflict and war. So that reading to me is a bridge to understanding yourself and to understanding other people in the world who are unlike you and very much like you at the same time.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Aaron Becker joins me once again on the podcast, this time as we celebrate the masterful conclusion to his Journey trilogy. It's All the Wonders of Return. Come celebrate with us. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.